We're talking with Dave Politis about Volume 3 of his massive work, Missing 411, North America and Beyond. We'll continue the conversation, including looking at new cases from a couple of clusters in particular areas that we've sort of touched on before. But these new cases are more chilling maybe than the stories you've heard before. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dave Politis, before the break, I interrupted your story at a very bad point, and I apologize for that, but can you pick up the tale from there?
Absolutely. So a friend of myself and I were in this national park. We walk into this little satellite office, and there's three guys sitting around a table, one guy in uniform behind the table, and they're talking, and they didn't seem to really care who was listening, so I just stood there and started listening, and I could tell that these two guys or three guys sitting there had some real detailed knowledge about the Park Service, and they seemed to be older types, probably retired, so I just stood there for about 20 minutes listening to them. One of the guys gets up and goes to the parking lot, and I approached him, and I said, hey, I'm an author, and I've written some stories about the parks, and if you had the time, I'd love to talk to you. And he opened Pandora's box. He was a retired special agent from the Park Service. And let me back up for a little bit. So the Park Service has law enforcement trained rangers, and they're different than the other rangers. They go to the Law Enforcement Training Academy, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy. Some of the best training in the world is there. And they come back, and they're dedicated law enforcement officers working for the Park Service. After you've been there for a number of years, if you want to be a detective, you go up and you become a special agent. And they're the detectives that do the follow-up work inside the park on criminal activity. If the case is really complex, they'll call in the FBI and an FBI evidence response team, and they'll do the real, real complex work. But the majority of the cases are handled by their special agents. That's what this guy was. It was a gold mine to me, because I'm finally going to hear some inside stuff. This guy was right there, very smart. And I explained to him exactly what I was doing, and I asked him, how can the Park Service not keep track of missing people? And blatantly say it, almost flaunt it, and not do anything about it. He said three words: lack of integrity. And he says that they want the public to have the image that this is where Smokey the Bear is at, yodi yodi yo, nice handsome guy in a park ranger suit, meet you, everything's fine here, nothing ever happens. And he says they don't want any publicity about the crime that goes on in a park. They don't want anyone to know how many people disappear. And they don't want you to know what happens after you disappear, because there are no resources in most instances to do anything about it. And I'm still talking to this person because he's a wealth of information. But just so the people out there who haven't heard this before, I got started on this with the help of two national park rangers. And through a series of Freedom of Information Act requests through the Park Service, we asked for a list of the people that were still missing inside their system. And the people have to understand, this isn't rocket science. You give me a pad of paper and a pencil and a clipboard, and you divide it up into rows: date missing, name, location, case number, disposition. Now you're tracking missing people. If they're found, put a checkmark at one end. If they've disappeared, the most important thing is that location. So if you find bones years later, you can kind of put it together. And when I asked them why they don't keep track of this, they said, oh, we don't need to, because we rely on the knowledge of the historical rangers that work in those areas over time, and they'll tell us what's going on. I said, you got to be kidding me. They said, nope, that's what we do. And I said, are there any plans in the future to keep track of this? Maybe, if we can get the right resources and the right money. And I explained what I just explained to you. This isn't rocket science. This doesn't take money. You could do it right here. You could keep track of all the disappearances in the entire Park Service on one laptop when people scan their sheet at each park and fax it in. That's all it takes.
And in this book, you say that that's what you do. You send them this info, don't you? You update them on cases.
George, we have a person from Microsoft, this woman who took an interest in what we're doing. And she started a database for us that is so thorough and so complete, it's unreal. And if it wasn't for her, I mean, it'd make our job a lot more difficult. But she's one of those people that's helped us kind of cross-reference these things that we're identifying as is unusual. But when we filed against the Park Service and asked them for their list, because I was a published author, I took that exemption, they said, no, your books aren't in enough libraries, so you don't get the exemption. I've never heard that. We never found it anywhere in any FOIA journals. That was their excuse. They said, but if you want that list from Yosemite, that's going to be $34,000, because we're going to have to make it from scratch. And if you want the list from our entire Park Service, it's going to cost you $1.4 million.
Well, that's ridiculous. Tell me this. The guy you're talking to, without giving away too much info, because you don't want to burn him, but did he indicate an understanding of what you meant after you explained what you're working on? Is that familiar to him? Did he shake his head and say, yeah, I know about those kind of cases, or not?
It's going to be hard to say this without burning him, but I'll make it real vague. The Park Service has so few resources. And he says it's because they don't want to spend the money, but they could if they wanted to. That was his explanation. That, like, in his position as a special agent, the territory he had to cover would turn your head. And when you're a special agent, you're doing most of your follow-up on criminal activity, even though missing persons would fall into that. He says, I've got no time to do that. I can barely have the time to follow up on major, major cases, like big felonies that happen in the park. And he says, they keep us spread so thin that we really can't do any proactive work to clear cases, because we're running around with a chicken with our heads cut off, going major case to major case, when we have, say, 8 parks we have to cover.
Let's go to one of your clusters mentioned in the newest version of Missing 411 North America and Beyond, Point Reyes National Park. You got 2 cases from 2010. Pretty recent. This is not ancient history. These are new ones.
And these are really unusual cases. And it was a complete fluke that I fell into them. At the time, I was living in San Jose, a suburb of San Jose, south of San Francisco. And on January 7th, 2010, a woman named Catherine Truitt was out taking a hike in Point Reyes National Park. It's north of San Francisco on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a beautiful area. It's a big park, but it's all along the coast. And she went out there, told her roommate where she was going. It's a location where she had gone maybe 60 times in her life. It's a regular place she went to hike. She was a tall lady, 6 feet tall, and she was disabled from work for a neck injury. And herein lies another part of what we'll talk about. There's a lot of people with injuries or illnesses that vanish. Keep that in the back of your mind.
Like they're culling the weak out of the herd or something.
As another one of your viewers said, they're trying to keep track of our chemistry and our DNA and how we hurt ourselves. I don't know. But anyhow, she goes to an area called Drake's Beach, parks her truck there, they think sometime around 1:30, and never comes back to her truck. And her dog was inside her car, her truck, and they ended up calling her house, and nobody was there. They leave the truck there for a couple days. Eventually, her roommate calls her parents call the police, the Park Service goes out, finds the vehicle, but she's never found. And she'd been going to this location for 20 years. Now, that in and of itself would not really signify much. You know, there's a lot of people who disappear along the coast, maybe. But this woman was pretty experienced. Well, just on she disappeared on the 7th of January. On the 24th of January, a woman named Sylvia Lang, who was a proctor and an assistant for the California State Park System, but every day she took her dogs to Point Reyes, and she took them for a walk. Well, what happened here is no one ever saw her walking her dog, even though she was in a real populated area. They found a dog on its leash with the leash caught in the rocks. They called the Park Service. They came out. They found her car with dogs in it. They found the dog on the beach, and they didn't find her. Now, she is also what we consider an intellect. She's a retired director of psychiatric training at the Seattle School of Nursing. She's a brilliant woman, and she cared about animals a lot. Again, this animal connection. The disappearances were 17 days apart. Now, where you have to think about this in some logical sense. Lang disappeared in an area where there are a lot of people, and Truitt disappeared in an area where there's hardly any people. Both their bodies were never found, and most of the time these bodies would have washed up onto the beach if they had gone out to sea. They have no other cases like this in their system in the last 20 years. Yet two women disappear in that short time frame, both inside the park, both almost essentially doing the same thing.
You have any new cases in which victims are found alive and say something about it? I know there were some in the first two volumes of the book where little kids will give you a little brief tantalizing clue about being carried away. It seems to me I remember something from the new Missing 411 book about a little girl with a story about being in a car.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a couple of cases in the new book where people were found alive, and they said some strange stories. There's a case out of Arkansas where a woman went fishing with her brother, got separated. She was lost for 5 days. When she was eventually found, she said that she saw people in the woods hiding behind bushes looking at her. And she would talk to them, but they wouldn't respond. And when she came close, they walked away and went further away. And she says she felt uncomfortable and she couldn't really explain it. But, this other case you're talking about was in Menominee, Michigan, and it's near Lake Erie. A girl named Beverly Ann Bradley, 2 years old, May 20th, 1953. She was staying at her grandparents' cottage, another time not with a family member, but at her grandparents' cottage. Somehow, 2 years old, I don't know how far a two-year-old can go, but she disappeared and the grandparents couldn't find her. That night, it started to rain hard, and it rained for several days off and on. For 48 hours, they had no clue on her at all. And 3 days into that search, they were bringing in U.S. Coast Guard to search over the woods because a lot of this area is watery, murky, and you get a better view from up above. And this was a small county sheriff's office. Coast Guard chipped in. They were flying over a swamp. And there was one place in this middle of this giant swamp that had almost like a small island to it. And they saw her laying face down on this island. So they sent searchers out to it, and they find her. And right away, whoever the searchers were smart, and they were aware. A lot of times searchers, and I don't blame them for this, but they're there to search and find. And they're not thinking criminal misconduct. They're not thinking unusual things. They're just there, grab the child, let's get him back, let's not think about it. These people thought about it. When they found her, they found that her shoes were dry and clean, even though the entire area she was around was wet and muddy. And they brought her back, and the sheriff for that county said, it was impossible for that child to have wandered in the dense woods like she did. And then searchers stepped forward and said, well, we had been in that area in the days previously, and she wasn't there. And the only thing she was wearing was underpants and a shirt and her shoes. And the sheriff believed the girl was kidnapped. Now, when she was questioned, you got to remember a two-year-old. And you got to when you talk to small kids, you got to put it in context. When she probably only knows any kind of vehicle is called a car. And she said she was taken away and carried away by a car. And she stayed in a house. Now, when you read this kind of stuff, we had a discussion about this as a team. What a car could mean to her could be a lot of things. And staying in a house could mean a lot of things. And that's all they ever found out about it, even though the sheriff believed the girl was kidnapped. There was never anything else done about it. But it's another one of those cases where the location they're found is an impossibility. How they got there doesn't make sense. What she describes happened couldn't have happened because there's no way a car could have gotten to where she was at. So you're perplexed about what's happening here.
Car being her word for a vehicle of some kind.
Some kind, yeah.
What about cause of death? In the people who are found, in the cases where bodies are found, is there a similarity in cause of death? I mean, I'm guessing that the little girl who was found in the closet that you talked about a little while ago died of starvation. But is that common? Are there signs of trauma in these bodies, or any similarities in the reasons why they died?
So no overt trauma like you may think in a serial predator abduction. I've never read a case where there was sexual misconduct. Almost all of these people who disappear have scratches on their body, sometimes bruising. But the commonality amongst the deaths are perplexing. Many times the doctors can't and won't say, probably because they don't understand why the person died. We've had some strange ones. One was called a mad moon disease. And that was in the Eastern book. Some doctor, I think it was in Pennsylvania, a girl died, and he said that she died from that. I have no idea what that is. a lot of them say that they died of shock, stress, or exposure. And a lot of times it doesn't make sense because it's in the middle of summer. The nights only get down to 65, 70 degrees. They're not in water. It's almost like their hands are crossed, and they have no idea what happened.
So they just come up with an excuse or an explanation.
Yeah.
Dave, we're going to take a break here in a moment and then come back and take some questions from listeners. I want, if we have a chance, to talk about Yosemite, because that's another of your clusters, one of the most important clusters, perhaps the most important cluster. It's where we started. Just very briefly, when you hear the music, it means we got to go to a break. But have you got new cases from Yosemite?
You know, there's new cases in Yosemite all the time. And at this point, we haven't had a lot of opportunity to look into those because the Park Service is withholding a lot of the new cases now for no reason. We just asked for a case. A man disappeared in Olympic National Park maybe 3 months ago. They called off the search, but they won't give us the case. And this is getting to be their common practice by saying, oh, we are still investigating. It's a missing person case. You called off the search. What else are you doing? And in talking to that special agent, they're not doing anything. They just don't want to give the case up because they know we're starting to connect the dots.
And do they, you find out about these cases from other media reports? I mean, do they give other media any kind of information, or you find out from families, or how?
All the above. A lot of times it's your listeners. But there's certain websites where we go to all the time, and we're looking for these cases. But what you read in the press about these is minimal. Maybe a name, the day they disappeared, and the general location they went in, and then that's all they're going to tell you.
You mentioned about listeners. I mean, there's a procedure that they should follow if they have cases, say, my Uncle Bob disappeared in a forest 30 years ago. What do they do with that info?
Well, if it fits that criteria that we talked about already, yeah, it sent it to us. And our website is Can-Am, like Canadian American, canammissing.com. If you go there, you'll find our website. You can see the contact information there. Send us an email and explain it, and we're glad to look at all these cases. The more cases, the better. And I don't care how old the case is. You have cases going back all the way to 1840.
And how many do you get in a week?
I say we probably get 50 inquiries a week. Out of that, maybe one, maybe two that fit.
Is this solvable?
I think it is. And I would say that these clusters that we've identified and the factors that we're starting to identify in these different cases, just like this case involving the two boys in Roseboro, North Carolina, I think you eventually start to connect the dots. And I think that comes by that team atmosphere when you're throwing ideas around. Rather than having one person sit there and just drain their own brain, that multitude of people throwing information, and even you and I exchange info on this all the time,
right.
So
yep.
It helps.
Dave Politis, author of Missing 411, North America and Beyond, is my guest. We'll open up the phone lines with your questions and comments right after this. We're talking with Dave Politis, author of Missing 411, this gigantic compilation, three books, the latest one being North America and Beyond. And when we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions for my guests. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Dave Politis is my guest. I know you have questions for him. Let's go to the phones. We have on west of the Rockies, April, in the Big Island of Hawaii. Hi, April. How you doing?
Hi. How are you tonight? I so appreciate you taking my call.
Glad to have you here. What's on your mind?
My son disappeared out of Point Reyes National Seashore in 2003. He was 29 years old. They never found his body or anything. His car was left there at Point Reyes with the keys in it. They kept trying to say that he drowned, but I don't believe that to be the truth because his wetsuit was still in his van.
Dave, does this ring a bell?
I haven't heard of it, but...
His name was William Myers, William Carl Myers. He was 29 when it happened at Point Reyes National Seashore, and there was a park bulletin filed with the National Park Service.
So what you want to do is you want to get a hold of the Park Service and ask for a copy of the report and then send the report to us.
You know, I don't know how to do that anymore. I had the number at one time, and I think I still have it saved on Yahoo. But I've had a problem with my account recently with them. But I can tell you what happened. My son just disappeared from Point Reyes, and later his van was found. He was never found. He was 29 years old. I can give you his name. The Park Service has a list of all those people that disappear there, but they never talk about it. I tried to get a list once because I started noticing on the internet, my internet searches, that other people have turned up missing there too.
April, are you saying that your internet service is spotty now? Because we could put you in contact with Dave and the two of you could work out a way where you could request that information and then share it.
Sure, I'd love to share that information.
I'm going to ask you to give your email address to Gina, who's our caller screener, and then we'll put you in contact with Dave, and the two of you can maybe work together on this and see what information you can get. Is that okay?
Oh, I so appreciate that so much.
All right, you hang on there. She'll get the information for you, and we'll pass it along. First-time caller, Gwenna. I think, Gwenna, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Hey, guys. Great show tonight.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Dave, you're talking a lot about the national parks and disappearances there, but I was kind of curious about some of the national forests, specifically on the Tonto in Arizona, the Superstition Wilderness, which is just east of the Phoenix Valley. Long history of a lot of intriguing incidents there and a lot of disappearances over the years. A lot of people never found. Wondered if you've looked into that in the past and what your thoughts were on it.
You know, that's a great question, and you would think that there would be something emanating out of there that would just jump out at us. We spent almost 4 months at one point digging deep into that area, and a majority of those disappearances come back to criminal misconduct.
Correct.
And then the ones that are still outstanding don't fit that narrow confines of what we look for in those disappearances.
Okay.
And it is a perplexing situation, and there are a lot of people that have disappeared, and we looked into a lot of cases. That's a good question,
okay.
Though.
All right, Dave, I appreciate it.
Thank you for the call. Dave, wasn't there a park ranger who disappeared somewhere there in Arizona, or am I thinking New Mexico?
No, Paul Fugate from Chiricahua Monument. He's never been found.
And is that near the area she was talking about?
Not real close, no.
Okay. Wildcard.
George,
go ahead.
One thing.
Sure.
We've gotten like 3 or 4 emails from people questioning the price of the books. And what they're doing is they're going to Amazon and they're seeing the books for sale for $60. And those are resellers. And we get a lot of complaints from this. Our books, $24.95 on our website. So don't go to Amazon. Go to our website and they're more than half the price.
People are reselling your books for $60 a pop?
Can you believe that?
Wow. Well, yeah, go to the website. We've got the link on our website at Coast to Coast AM. On the wildcard line, Ani, hello, in Indiana, I believe. Good morning, or good evening. Lonnie, hello? Hello, Lonnie. Bonnie, I'll get it right here one of these times.
Yeah, I think you're talking about Bonnie. Okay, yeah, thank you for taking my call. I've just been listening to you all here for a while about the missing children, and I'm just curious if either of you remember the interview that Al Bielek gave when he talked about in detail about the Montauk Project and how they were using children for that, and how he said that they initially were using children that were, you know, from homes, people's homes, and they decided after a while it was causing enough ruckus that they would start taking children from the street, you know, from homeless children and things like that. He claims that in 1 year, 250,000, okay, in his interview, that many children. So I wouldn't be surprised, you know, based on the circumstances and the things that you're saying of how these children are disappearing and how they're coming back, based on just the things that he said about how some of them couldn't be retrieved, how some of them, most likely they were trying to put them back in a certain place and weren't very successful, you know, during all of this. Also, Andrew Basiago has attested to the fact that he also was involved in projects where they were using children with DARPA. I think it was in the late 60s, early 70s, where the children were also being teleported, time-traveled, whatever, basically experiments with children. It seems that for whatever reason, our military got involved in that, which was a terrible thing, a terrible travesty. But I think that explains a lot of these disappearances. And I hope, you know, it's a sad thing, but it sounds like that is what was done in many of these cases. And I just, as far as connecting the dots, it's certainly, you know, when you're talking about the exactitude of the way a certain child will disappear and then they wait a amount of time, you know, they're very careful about taking from certain places, too many at once, too much suspicion in one area. Also, all these deep underground bases are underneath national forest areas, okay? And what are they doing in there? They're doing experiments. So it's very sad, but that's what it sounds like is going on. And I'd be interested in hearing your comment on that, Dave.
So the 250,000 people a year that are missing, that's a bad statistic.
Well, yeah. I didn't say a year, just overall. He just mentioned that in 1 year. I'm not saying that was every year, but if you'll listen to his interview, he did mention that was in 1 year.
Okay, let's let Dave answer then.
So the FBI keeps statistics on missing people. And let's just say in 1 year, they have a list of 70,000 people that disappear. So if a teenager runs away from home for 3 hours, they come back that night, the police have taken a report, that's one case. 99% of the cases that you read about on that FBI annual report are solved and the people are found. What the cases we're concerned about are unknown perpetrator abductions. And sometimes, if it's a known perpetrator, I'm not interested. Unknown perp, if they classify it like that, it's a whodunit and the person's not around. The number of cases like that are so minuscule that we're talking maybe a couple hundred a year in the U.S., and that's it. The vast, vast majority of those statistics are getting used wrong, and it's not. And I'm telling you, I was involved in this for a long time. If anybody can remember back to the Polly Klaas disappearance, I was part of a mutual team that went out there. There was almost 60, 70 officers and FBI agents working that case at one time up in Petaluma. I got to learn what those numbers meant, and people use them incorrectly.
I would say Bonnie raises an interesting point, but a lot of the cases that you're looking at are a long time ago, long before there were any military underground bases, so that can't be an explanation for all of them.
I would have no idea. I'm not an expert on underground military bases,
yeah.
Though.
But, I mean, that would make sense. You're looking at cases back to the 1880s that we didn't have any underground military bases back then, that's for sure.
Well, at least we didn't.
Yeah, and we didn't. That's what I meant. Thanks for the call, Bonnie. Appreciate it. East of the Rockies, Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you very much for everything that you do. It's greatly appreciated. I have a quick little story and question. I was a private investigator for 15 years. I'm almost 50 years old now, but this happened when I was a child, and I could have been one of these people. I grew up riding horses in the woods with my friends. My brothers rode dirt bikes, so I learned to ride dirt bikes as well. Three of us were on a dirt bike. We're small. We can all fit. We're riding through the woods where we've ridden many, many times. It's called Harford Glen. It's in Maryland. And I wanted to get off the bike. I got off the bike. My friends took off down the trail. We know this area like the back of our hand. As soon as they go down the trail, I hear a very loud thud. and I could feel it. It was heavy. Now, I have horses. I know 1,500-pound animals and what they feel like when they stomp their feet from flies. So I know what heavy animals sound like when they hit the ground. This was a biped. It was two-legged. And I heard thud. I heard some brush move. I heard thud, 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 thud. And it was getting closer to me, and I had instant fear. Now, I've never been afraid in the woods ever, and I've ridden my horse many times as a kid by myself or been in the woods by myself. I had instant fear and instant panic. And this thing was running towards me in long, heavy strides. And I took off running down that trail like nobody's business, screaming at my friends. I caught up to them on the dirt bike, and I was screaming and just yelling and screaming for them to stop. They stopped. I jumped on that bike and said, go, go, go. We took off up the trail and back to my friend's house, which we were not far from houses at all. It was amazing. I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. They had to take me home. My brothers went out and searched the area. They didn't find anything. They did find large footprints, like 12, 13-inch footprints.
Like Bigfoot footprints or shoed footprints?
Footprints, like Bigfoot footprints. Now, this was at a wildlife sanctuary called Harford Glen in Maryland, and the road was a dead-end road right to the woods. You know, we rode the horses from the farm, which was maybe a mile away, you know, all through this area, all through the woods, everywhere. We knew this area. There's trails like the back of our hand. We grew up in these woods. Yeah. It was a biped. It was a biped. It was large, big, and heavy. I mean, I'm used to 1,500-pound animals. You know, I know what they sound like when they stomp their feet, when they jump, when they land on the ground, you know, all these kind of things. This thing was big and heavy and a biped. And I didn't know if you had any, you know, any stories from Maryland or the Eastern Shore area, you know, in that. But I could have been, I'm shaking right now telling the story, and I'm almost 50.
Wow, that's a heck of a story.
I remember every detail like it was yesterday.
Dave, you heard one like that before?
Never heard one like that before. I can tell you that there's a lot of cases from the Eastern Shore, though. Haven't heard of Harford Glen, but lots in that area in general.
It's in Bel Air, Maryland. It's in Bel Air, Maryland. It was a little historic town at the time. Now it's grown tremendously. It's, you know, the population has increased very much. It's a large city now. But back then, it was a little historic town, and my hand to God, every word of that is true. I'm shaking right now telling it to you. But my brothers went out. They couldn't believe, you know, they've never seen me like that before or since, you know. And like I said, we all knew the area like the back of our hand. And it was a marsh, you know, it was a wetland area. It was preserved for wildlife and the bird life, and, you know, it was a sanctuary. And, you know, there was houses on the outskirts of it, but...
Kelly, maybe you and you could write to Dave, connect through the website. I got a feeling he might want to get a couple of notes down about this.
Absolutely. Surely.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. And Dave, I guess you would encourage with people with stories like that to get a hold of you.
Sure. Absolutely.
We're going to go to Rob in Vancouver, try to get one more call in. Rob, what's on your mind?
Thanks very much for taking my call. From Vancouver, it's really easy to get out into wilderness, and, you know, I've been fascinated with these stories. And starting to pay attention, I realized that, you know, out in the wilderness here, the people disappear all the time. And I do a lot of deep wood, backwood hiking and so on. And I've come to places that where you just feel strange and feel odd. And there have been places where I've gone to, you know, talking like 50, 60 miles in the middle of nowhere, where I've gone and, you know, I've met Aboriginal people, you know, in an area kind of, I don't want to say protecting it, you know, asking, well, what are you doing here and so on. And about 2 years ago, I started talking to some of the Aboriginal tribes around here, and it took me quite a while to get their confidence. But, you know, they started telling me about stories and areas that are just bad. you know, just don't go there, just offside. You know, and I've told them I've been to places and what I've seen, and, you know, they've said to me, well, you know, if you haven't been hurt yet, you know, you're okay. And I'm wondering if, you know, in all the research, if there's a connection or if you found things, you know, relating to Native American history or stories or legends that tie in with this.
Well, first of all, that area north of Vancouver has a long history of disappearances, very strange disappearances. And there's a couple of lakes in that area where prospectors have come out and said, oh, boy, that was scary, and I'm not going back. And
oh, yeah, so, Pitt Lake. Yeah, yep. Pitt Lake and Harrison Lake, scary places.
Those are both the ones I was thinking about. And there's a long history there with the First Nations people and the prospectors that they got scared so bad they would never go back. And there's some great stories about an old prospector going way back into Pitt Lake and finding an area that was like 80 degrees. It was almost like a Garden of Eden. It didn't fit the region, and he was lost for a couple weeks. He eventually found his way back out, but it's almost like he was on another planet. And that area of British Columbia has a very, very sordid history.
Thanks for the call, Rob. That's great information, and it sort of leads you to some exotic type explanations, Dave, that I know you're reluctant to get into. Dimensional things, you know,
right.
Vortex portals. That stuff is above my pay grade as well. But I mean, you have to be open to all possibilities in trying to solve this thing.
Exactly.
Do you allow yourself to go there?
Oh no, we discuss that kind of stuff all the time. I mean. People like your listeners who are more attuned to that than we are, I get those kind of ideas all the time. And probably one of the questions I commonly ask is, on portals, how do you explain that they're there one day and gone the next? Or if it's a wormhole, that they're here one day and gone the next, similar to what you guys had going at the ranch.
You've developed such great relationships with indigenous peoples, your Bigfoot research, the Hoopa project. Have you ever put the question to any of your friends on that end about, hey, what do you know about this?
Well, and we always have. And one of the first things when we went on to the Hoopa Reservation or a couple of different reservations in Oklahoma was the people would start talking to us about UFOs. And they tended to use the word star people all the time. And a majority of these tribes believe that they came from the star people. And so when they see those UFOs, to them, it's not so abnormal like to a city slicker like you and I. But to them, I think a lot of tribes see them more than you think. And so
that's an explanation for the disappearances? They think it's related to the star people?
No, but that's just what they start talking to, almost like a comfort zone that they go to when you start talking about unusual things.
Where to for you now, Dave? We've just got a minute left or so here. What next for you? Just to continue to collect cases, hope you can get a breakthrough with the Park Service? Dave, I'm sorry, the music is telling me that we don't have enough time for that, but if you can very quickly tell us what your next project is and where people can go for more information.
Go to the CanAmMissingProject.com, and just go to CanAmMissing.com. You can come up with us. You can find everything you need about current cases and about things that we're on the verge of. I think we're going to stick with this for the next couple years at least, because I think we're making some good headway.
Dave, I really appreciate it. Every time you come here, it chills me to the bone, but it's always great information. Thanks, and best of luck to you, and please keep us in the loop.
George, you're a great host. Thank you.
Thanks. Coming up next, Bryce Zabel, the what ifs if John F. Kennedy had not been killed.